Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And today, with long days and warm weather sliding back into the Anchorage forecast, we're talking summer baseball. Baseball, the all-American sport. But Alaska has a special relationship with baseball that goes back to the 1800s and whaling crews up in the Arctic who played on a diamond out on the ice. And then there's Indigenous baseball, players with a stick and a ball and a baseline. It's always been popular here. But especially when Anchorage was a fledgling city being carved literally out of the wilderness, baseball was here too, a kind of coin of the realm that both reminded newcomers of home but let them play the game the way they wanted to play it. Alaska broke ground on gender and racial fronts ahead of the rest of the country. All that enthusiasm eventually led to one of America's best summer college leagues still in action today. Here to share some of this history and culture with us is Katie Ringsmuth, a public historian and a history professor. Welcome, Katie.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We're delighted to have you. And a couple things I want to point out to folks. We welcome your questions. If you are a player on a team or if you have questions about baseball history in Anchorage, which was so colorful and rich, we've got a great guest for you today who can answer some of your questions. We also have some wonderful links on the website. You may recall home field advantage that the museum had up for the centennial celebration. Well, Katie was the curator of that. So she if you love that exhibit and you have questions about it, she can probably address them. But we've also got, you know, different links on the site. And one of the reasons we really have the show today also is to make sure you know that we're going to be showing Ken Burns' Jackie Robinson 4-hour, two-part documentary next week. And we want to make sure you know, if you're a baseball fan, this is something you're not going to want to miss. It's Monday at 8, so that's April 11th at 8, and Tuesday, April 12th at 8. So settle down for 2 hours of great baseball each night. Another thing I want to alert our folks to is that we've got a little video of Katie up on the website, just talking about baseball in early Anchorage. And if you go to Alaska Public Media, you can't miss it. It's right there on the homepage. It's about 3 minutes, and it's a really fun introduction. Some great historical photos in there, and some of the stories behind baseball in early Alaska. So I'm going to throw out our numbers, and we'll get started talking, Katie.
Yeah.
So if you are in Anchorage, it is 550-8433. And around the state, if you've got some baseball questions, and baseball was played and is played everywhere around this state, you can call us at 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's get started, Katie. One of the things I wanted to find out, just a little bit about you, you're a public historian, and I just love the idea that we have a public historian. So how do you become a public historian? I know you study history, but you have a public focus.
Right, yes. Well, Ken Burns is a public historian,
yeah.
Right? I think, you know, the kind of the difference, which is you have the academic historians and then you have the public historians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think kind of a... Oh, rather a surface comparison is that public historians attempt to make history very accessible. And I think, for example, the story of Jackie Robinson is wonderful because I also teach American history at UIA. And, you know, Jackie Robinson's story isn't just about baseball. He is an important American figure.
Oh,
I'd argue
yeah.
one of the most important American figures, especially the moment when he broke the color barrier in baseball in 1947. And
yeah.
public historians, I think what we strive to do is tell that story so that it's not just a lecture. It's not critical analysis. I mean, it is, but it's really making that story rich and a part of the American story.
Right. I mean, it's not dusty. It's not, you know, in books. It's captured out on the field and, you know, in
yeah.
stories. And I was going to say there was a great quote talking about the Jackie Robinson. This is a Martin Luther King quote saying, Jackie Robinson was a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom writer before freedom writers. So it's really going to be a great story. And you know about that story. Yeah.
Oh, sure. You know, we think of the end of Jim Crow, the end of segregation with Brown v. Board of Education. Mm-hmm. And that was the mid-50s. And Jackie came before that. So baseball, in many ways, led the rest of America in the and they also actually started it, too, because they, through a gentleman's agreement, they limited African-Americans from the game back in the 1880s, which was actually before Plessy v. Ferguson passed.
Wow. So in the lower 48, as you say, that was the rule of the day. But you come up to Anchorage and something different happened. And we'll talk more about
okay.
that. So I wanted to also say that was a fabulous exhibit at the Anchorage Museum, Home Field Advantage, Baseball in the Far North. And it was so rich and so much. I just kind of wanted to know, how long did you spend on that? Did you go down to Juneau and do research in the State Museum? Or how did it all come together?
Well, I actually didn't have a lot of time to work on that. So luckily, I had been focused on baseball. It's been a passion of mine. Julie Decker had asked me to curate it along with other projects that I was working on. So luckily, she was a great fan of baseball, too. So we were able to bring that to Anchorage for the centennial.
Really fun, but not a lot of time. Very rich and full. And I just thought, well, it's a good thing you had a background in it.
Well, it's also a story that tells itself. I mean, I've just scratched the surface, I think. And I would love to get into the research and actually approach it, not just as a public historian, but as an academic historian, too, because I think there's an important story to tell that transcends, you know, a sport and really upholds this larger story of Alaska history.
Yeah, the Alaska story, the American story. I wanted to ask you... I know. I wanted to say that to me, when I met you the other day and was looking at all your materials, and you to me were Alaska's Doris Kearns Goodwin. You know, I remember listening to her in the Ken Burns baseball series and the way, you know, as a kid, she talked about her dad taking her to games. Her mother introduced her to books. Her dad introduced her to baseball. It's been a lifelong love of yours as well. What were your beginnings in baseball?
Well, first of all, thank you for that compliment, because Kearns Goodwin is just, she's like an idol, right?
She's
one of the great
too.
American historians working today. So thank you. And like Doris Kearns Goodwin's, I too fell in love with baseball at an early age. I grew up in Seattle, so I was in the second grade when the Mariners came to town. I wasn't old enough to remember the Pilots, but I do remember the Mariners. And, you know, when we go to the Kingdom with my grandpa, being typical, you know, Northwesterners, we'd get raincoats.
Come rain or shine, right? You're in the seats.
I love the Mariners, and I played T-ball, and I played in the Little Leagues, and I, you know, went all the way up into a high school. I was a four-year letterman. We were state championships in softball, not baseball, but of course. So this is something that I've always loved in a game that I've shared with my family for
a very long time. Great.
And the Mariners won today, by the way. In the ninth inning, they came back, so it's good to have baseball back. Yeah.
It's a good day for you.
Yeah, okay. I was watching, kind of keeping an eye on it on my cell phone while teaching class today, so I probably shouldn't say that. I probably just caught myself
in
big
trouble. What was she glancing down at?
My students are like, hey, no.
That's great. So I thought maybe we could start with you sort of I mentioned in the intro about these whaling ships in the 1800s. And let's talk just a little bit about the before Anchorage was in anybody's mind, baseball was all over. So just talk a little bit about that.
Right off the bat, you're totally challenging that mythology of baseball, the pastoralism, the springtime, the grass, right?
The summer. Yeah.
Right, yeah. No, in Alaska, some of the first competitive games that we know about were played way up north on Herschel Island, right up there on the Beaufort Sea. These are the 1890s, and these whalers, they'd gathered together, and they literally passed the time playing baseball. And this is like 40 below. It's cold outside, and they take the ash from the ships, and they draw the lines with the ash. And these weren't just pickup games. They had rules, and there were people who came up and wrote about these games. Frederick Funston, for example, was a lieutenant, and he observed this, and he talked about how they were using Spalding's rules of baseball. So they had it measured perfectly. They were serious, yeah. Although they gambled a lot. That was another byproduct.
That was kind of fun to see. Yeah. There was gambling with respect to artifacts and things like that. Yeah.
And in fact, Spalding took Funston's story that was published in Harper's, and he published it in his Baseball American Pastime, book that was so famous in 1911. And actually, there's a print of baseball in Alaska, which is interesting because it shows the people watching baseball, not just the players. And one thing that Funston was particularly interested in was he was amazed at how cosmopolitan. You know, you had the whalers who came from all over the place. And then he said, the typical baseball cranks, the indigenous people who were watching this game, there were Athabascan and Inupiaq people there watching. And he just said that this was one of the most cosmopolitan places that he'd ever experienced, about as far away from New York City as you can get.
That's wild. I almost wish I could have seen that. I mean, there are some pictures of it, a painting, actually. It's a painting, right? Of the diamond. And I think there was also a soccer field, too, that they put together. Let's talk a little bit about indigenous baseball, because that comes up in your talk. And what is it?
Well, you know, Funston kind of makes the mistake that this is the first time Alaska Native people were introduced to this game. But in fact, as Frederica de Laguna has pointed out in her field work, human beings have hit balls with sticks. It's a universal game.
Mm-hmm. And can't resist.
Right. And indigenous baseball, what's fascinating, what kids today will call Eskimo baseball or Aleut baseball, is actually a sport that originated, we think, somewhere in Siberia near Finland. And the Russians, when they colonized Alaska, they brought this game called Lapta, which is a sport that archaeologists have evidence that goes back to like the 14th century. So, and it's a very different kind of, it's not like American baseball at all, but they do hit a ball with a stick. And it's very different. Mm-hmm. You try to, like the pitcher wants you to hit the ball, opposed to in American game, they try to strike you out. Mm-hmm. But this is a game that the Russians brought to the southern areas of which they colonized. And then the indigenous Sami reindeer herders brought a version of this game to the northern areas, Yupik and Inupiaq people. And they adopted this game that's very, very similar, likely has a similar origin. But what I find really interesting about this is that even though it represents a form of colonization, Alaska Native people, both in the North and the South, have embraced this game. They've incorporated it into their own culture, and it's very much a part of who they are. And what I love about it, it is this game that they talk about being a way to bring people together, both the people playing and the spectators alike. Mm-hmm. And, it's still a game that's played at the end of Lent, the beginning of Easter. Kids up north play this game in the wintertime. It's been expressed in a form of a kickball rather than hitting. It's just so it's a really wonderful way. And I always thought it'd be a wonderful way that you could connect. For example, kids could bring this game and teach kids here in Anchorage how to play. It would be a nice way to intersect cultures. Yeah. And
do you think it's indigenous baseball still being played around?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You were able to find that out. Yeah, so it hasn't fallen away.
Uh-uh. Yeah. It's still very much played today.
That's great.
And it's a Native game. It's, it is expressed and valued as an Alaska Native game.
Hmm. Have you ever seen any comparisons side by side about nothing? No, that's research you can still do, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I think it'd be great. And I think it'd be a great experience for kids to learn how to play Alaska baseball.
Yeah.
I think that would be here in Anchorage.
More a part of being an Alaskan, you know. And so it's not the story that baseball was brought up here from the lower 40. It was here before this indigenous baseball was here before.
Yeah, I guess it came up during the Cold War and there was like, no way is baseball from Russia.
Oh, but, I see.
Yeah. But so it takes on its nuances.
Depending
on the historical context.
So, but you've done a lot of work around Anchorage, and we're in Anchorage, and a big part of our audience is in Anchorage. And I'm just going to, if folks have just joined us, I just want you to know we have Katie Ringsmith on with us. She's a historian, public historian, but also a history professor. But public history is a way of sort of explaining our way of life through our games, through our sort of open popular culture, I guess you could say. And I'm going to throw out our numbers, 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. Or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I wonder if we'll hear from any baseball players out there, you know? I mean, leagues are probably not yet playing, right? Your kids are playing, I think you said.
Oh, well, they'll start in May, the league start. Unfortunately, my little man broke his leg skiing over spring break, so.
Ouch.
Yeah, we're going to miss at least a couple weeks of opening.
You think he'll play this season?
Maybe a little bit.
We'll have to see
we'll get him out there and play catch.
Knits
sure.
back together. Yeah. So anyway, I'd love to just talk a little bit about early Anchorage. This was some of the pictures I've seen. We're down in Tent City. We're down on Ship Creek. But there's a ball field, and it looks like just about any ball field you could see anywhere. I mean, it's orderly, and there are lots of spectators. And when do you think we had the first one down on Ship Creek?
1915.
Oh yeah,
they came up to build the railroad, they brought with them baseball. The surveyors mm-hmm. They brought baseball with them. Mm-hmm. Gold miners brought baseball with them. Mm-hmm. It was the American pastime by then. Ty Cobb had the batting record in 1910. So this was a game that Americans who came to Alaska played and brought with them, and it was a little piece of home, and it was important to them. And I think that's when it dawned on me. I mean, here's that picture of Ship Creek, and just this tent city in the wilderness behind them,
and trees right
as
behind
as if they
it.
Had time
and
to
mud
sit around
everywhere,
and play.
Yeah.
Right? You know, but they did. And it was in building a baseball field is. It takes time, right? It's hard.
And
it's
space.
Right?
So you can't have a mini version.
No, and so it was extremely important to Anchorageites, and it did make them feel like they weren't as isolated. That was a quote from a woman who was a spectator, and she said this. You know, there was a friend of hers who couldn't understand why Anchorage was so baseball crazy, as they described it, and she said, it's because it made us feel like we weren't so isolated.
Yeah.
And that was important to them.
And it was isolated, I mean, so I guess sort of bringing some of this pleasure from their home connected them back to their home. But it also, these people came from all over, and it was a common language. I mean, they could all play.
Exactly. Right. Outside of the indigenous people who were here, Anchorage was made up of people from all over the place.
Right.
All over the place.
Other countries.
They didn't have a common background, really, that they shared. They were dissimilar people from, places from all over, but they had similar hopes and dreams.
Yeah. Entrepreneurs, adventurers.
Yeah, they came up here to start a life. And baseball was something that they could all kind of rally around, they could focus on. And it wasn't just one team either. Within those 5 years before Anchorage Incorporated, when it was, run by the
railroad.
Railroad, right. It had four professional teams and four amateur teams, all within the Cook Inlet area. And that's just South Central. I mean, this was happening all over. Nome, Fairbanks,
down
southeast,
in Southeast, Ketchikan. Yeah.
Even in Alaska, they were playing baseball.
Right. That's amazing. Did they have a league where they traveled, or did they just invite teams to play with them? Or how did they organize themselves so they had, I mean, if you have four teams in Anchorage, they can play each other. But did Fairbanks come down? Did Ketchikan come up?
Well, in Cook Inlet, they had their Cook Inlet League, right? So they had a team. The railroad team was at Ship Creek. You had a city team, Athletic Park, which is actually the location where the Anchorage Museum sits today.
Okay.
That was where the Athletic Park was. Then you had a team in Matsu Junction, which was kind of on the way for the coal fields. So they already had a spur out to the Matsu coal fields. And then there was a team at Turnagain Arm. The railroad hadn't yet connected yet to Seward, but some of the earliest uses of the Alaska Railroad was to go to baseball games, and the railroad even had excursion trips, and 1,000 people. I couldn't even believe these. Now, this is going on the numbers that I'm getting out of the newspapers, and they could have exaggerated. I have no doubt about that. But they were saying, you know, something like 200, 300, 400 people were at Turnagain Arm and Matsu, and 1,000 people were watching games at Athletic Park in downtown
That's
Anchorage.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's
I mean, the
incredible.
Town was, well, I think I read that the town grew, and I'm not sure if this is accurate either, but in 1 year to 10,000 people.
Yeah, it wasn't quite 10,000, but at its peak, there was about, I'm guessing 7,000. I'll probably get corrected by that. But that was a peak. Then it slowly, or actually very quickly, disappeared with the arrival of World War I.
Right. Actually, that brings me to something else I saw in your work about how important baseball was in Anchorage as a way to support the war effort. I mean, you say Anchorage kind of disappeared because I guess people went to war.
Yeah. And it took out the railroad workers and it took out baseball players too. It was patriotic duty. And it certainly demonstrated that Anchorage wasn't as isolated as they all thought they were.
They could reach in and get them.
They're very much impacted. And what was fascinating is you had four teams, and then you were quickly down to two teams by 1918.
Right. And did that give rise to women's teams then? I mean, were they women there all along, or were they just when there were so fewer men, they started their own teams and leagues?
Well, the women's story, in terms of looking at women through the lens of baseball, is really interesting. You know, after the Civil War, college teams all over the country had women's teams. And women played. And then you start getting into the Victorian era, and then all of a sudden it was far too dangerous to let our women be playing these games, right? So you had the social conventions really kind of end that. You did have some barnstorming women teams, but they were of a different class, right? Now you see 1915 Anchorage. Women are coming up as well as men. And women were playing. They wanted to play, and they didn't really have those barriers, those social restrictions.
Norms.
No. And in fact, the newspaper advertised the women's club as the furthest north women's team in America.
Wow.
The North Star Women. In Nome, they had a team, the Lady Strikers. And because of the cold, they tended to play inside, indoor baseball, which, of course, would manifest as softball, one of the most popular sports to play in America.
Do you think it started up here? I mean, is that the because it was so cold, they played indoors? You don't know.
I don't know. Terrence Cole writes about indoor baseball. It was popular all over the northern areas. But, yeah, they played it up here. And it was very popular before some of the more traditional sports we see now, like basketball and volleyball. So, indoor baseball was really popular.
I love the pictures of the women. They have sort of sailor suit type shirts on with, you know, white, very white, and kind of like bloomers, I think. They kind of, and maybe long socks, and then kind of not really tennis shoes, but kind of athletic kind of shoes, you know. But they just, their clothing was really interesting, and I thought how easy was it to move around in those clothes, you know?
Well, it must have been pretty easy. I don't think they were that ladylike, because they would play the men. And they play the local Shamrocks team, which was owned by a local bar owner. And not only did they play them, but occasionally they beat them, too.
Yeah, and I think I read that men would sometimes bat left-handed to sort of equalize the...
Yeah, that was the handicap. They had to bat left-handed and run the bases backwards. They said left-legged, but I was like, what does that mean? I don't know what running left-legged means, but I'm assuming it meant running the bases the other way.
And was Ramparts, it was called, what was the name of that, the bar that had the team? Robard?
Oh, Robart, yeah.
Robart. Was that the name of a man? And then and then the Shamrocks were his...
Yeah, and his wife was very enthusiastic in the women's club, and she was one of the drivers that... for for raising the money for the orphans during World War I, and they were able to raise over $8,000,
wow,
which is pretty extraordinary considering Anchorage only had about 2,500 people by that year.
That's amazing. That's a lot of money in those dollars. I don't know. It's just amazing. Why do you think the women, especially the women's club, was so engaged with this? I mean, I guess it was something to do in Anchorage. You know, it was an activity that everybody could come together on. And I mean, was food part of it? Was picnics part of it?
Oh,
did
yeah.
you ever see stuff like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, Lieutenant Mears was here. They were actually getting, he was going off to war too. So it was a big fundraiser. And it was, they had a play, which they wrote and performed, which
wow.
received pretty good reviews, apparently.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
They had a big dance. And then the next day, they had a baseball game,
uh-huh.
the YMC Reds versus the Masons. And it was at Athletic Park, and it was really the centerpiece of the fundraising weekend.
That's just amazing. I saw the picture of the Red Cross benefit. There was a Red Cross benefit game the day before the season would begin, and that was a different fundraiser of some sort, and they'd raised $250 mm-hmm. before the season even began. We've got a caller, so I'm just going to welcome. Hi, Caroline. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes, hi. This is Caroline. I wanted to, first of all, mention the depth of knowledge that's being exhibited there certainly qualifies, if not beyond, Kearns Goodwin.
So, oh, okay.
I remember first time I got to Fairbanks was 67, and I was astounded at the names that eventually went on to the pros. Kingman was one. Tom Seaver had been there just before I got a chance to see him. And Red Boucher was Mr. Baseball. I mean, he seemed to lead the charge there, former lieutenant governor and former computer expert in his old age.
I remember him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the thing that I saw was that was one area of cooperation between the two towns because they were so competitive on everything else. But the summers just seemed to wipe a lot of that stuff away, and they were cooperative. So I'm curious as to examples of their cooperation.
Between Fairbanks and Anchorage, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And what is the status of baseball today, and are our young kids getting involved in it?
Thanks, Caroline. We'll jump in and get some of that. So go ahead, Judy.
Okay, well, in terms of cooperation, I don't know. They sounded like they were big rivals.
but, you wouldn't call it cooperation, yeah. but they did want to play. They did want to play.
Oh, absolutely.
Cooperated enough to play.
You know what I think is really fascinating? In 1965, Satchel Paige, you know, the caller mentioned some of the great players who came up to Alaska to play.
Right.
Well, we just happened to have, in 1965, one of the greatest players to ever play the game come up and play in Anchorage for an exhibition game in 1965. In 1965, that's a rough year in America, right?
Yes,
Selma March, the Voting Rights Act. Civil rights, you know, is really turbulent. And yet, in Anchorage, in 1965, Anchorageites welcome Satchel Paige. This was a year after the earthquake. And
was that why he came up? Or
well, I don't know if it's exactly why he came up, but he fell in love with Alaska, and he told a reporter in the paper that he was going to start a team called the Anchorage Earthquakers. Well, it turns out he was probably just sort of promoting and letting his agent know that he could leave, so he better increase his paycheck.
Yeah, better take care of me.
But what he did really was increase just the enthusiasm and excitement for baseball in Alaska. Well, about this same time, Red Boucher and Don Dennis in Fairbanks are starting the Alaska Baseball League with the Alaska Goldpanners.
Mm-hmm.
And your caller was absolutely right. Some of the best baseball players to play came up and played. Greg Nettles, Dave Kingman, Bob Boone, Bill Spaceman Lee, some people might remember him. And of course, they all played for the renowned coach Jim Dietz, who I had the pleasure of having many, many, many conversations with, and was just talk about a scholar of baseball. And Alaska will produce three Hall of Famers, Tom Seaver, Dave Winfield,
mm-hmm.
and then just recently, Randy Johnson.
Amazing.
Tom Seaver, who also received the Cy Young Award, he attributes his experience
uh-huh.
of baseball in Alaska and to really teaching him the value of hard work. And Dave Winfield, who I had the pleasure of speaking with.
Oh, how cool.
It was, it really was. I was so nervous. But he told me that it was Jim Dietz who recognized that, because he was a pitcher, and he came up as a pitcher, and you know, he usually had the best ball players pitch, but he recognized that he was also this excellent hitter, and so he became a regular player and a fantastic outfielder for the New York Yankees.
Wow.
And, by the way, an awesome hitter. And then, of course, Randy Johnson, he played for the Pilots, and the Pilots... And so they all played in the collegiate league at, you know, for the a national
That's
championship.
That's so cool.
And
yes.
The goal panners were so good. They would be, you know, at the championship until the Pilots came along in 1968, and they actually played the panners for the championship, and it was the Pilots who won. So baseball gave Alaska its very first national championship.
That's awesome. I'm going to welcome a caller on. Hi, Jeff. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi.
Yes, my name is Jeff Venus. I'm 30 years old, and I'm from Bethel, Alaska. I just caught the part where you guys were talking about lap game, and that's funny because I played lap game here in Anchorage 2 days ago, the day before yesterday, with a group of kids from the YK Delta.
Awesome.
How cool is that?
I would love to play with other kids here in Anchorage because we have so much fun, and it's nothing but laughing the whole time. It
nice.
Seems like.
I would love to get a group of kids together to teach some of the kids here in Anchorage how to play. Wouldn't that be just a cool thing?
That would be great. I grew up playing lap game, and some of the kids knew how to play. We have about 15 kids here from a half a dozen villages that are in town for career and post-secondary education with our nonprofit called Excel Alaska.
Hmm.
And I had to teach some of the kids, but about half of the kids knew it as Eskimo baseball.
Yep.
That's so cool.
Well, you know, I don't know how to play. So maybe we can get in touch later and you can we can maybe set something up.
Yes, definitely. I'd love to see this game go on. And I've played it with just a few family and friends at family get-togethers to huge groups of people, you know, at the holiday or the 4th of July holiday celebrations we have over the summer.
So, Jeff, could you just, in a sentence or two, tell us how similar it is to the baseball we might be more familiar with and how it's different? Just an example or two so we can
sure.
get a picture of that.
Yeah, it's a great game. We play it with a wiffle ball or a wiffle bat, but you could play it with a stick and something that you hit. Hopefully, you know, It has to be something soft because one way to get out is being hit by the ball. So we don't play it with a real baseball or anything.
Me too, people.
And, and there's no bases, so it's like baseball with a safe zone. And to score a game, I mean, to score a run, you have to run from the pitching box or the batter's box, I'm sorry, to the safe zone and back. So I guess that's why we called it lap game growing up.
Going down, laps.
Yeah. Also, it was brought by the Sami, who were the
Laplanders,
yeah. Right?
Yeah. And Katie, you said, and I'm asking Jeff if you remember this, the point is to hit the ball. We're in American baseball. You're trying to, you know, get past the batter. So is that right, Jeff? You're the batter or the person.
Put the ball in play.
Is really trying to put the ball in play.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I did catch that when she said that. And that's exactly how we played the other day. The kids. They weren't sure about that, but I said, no, we want you guys to hit. So the pitcher stands right next to the batter, kind of right out of the way, lets the batter tap the ball to about waist level where they'd like to hit it, and then they stand back, the batter winds up, you throw the ball up in the air just a couple feet, and it comes down, and hopefully they get a hit. We still play with strikes, so you can strike out. And there's unlimited balls, so nobody ever walks.
Yeah.
And there's no stealing.
Kinda
it's
like dodgeball.
A lot of fun, though.
That's
yeah.
great. That's
awesome.
Great. So what was the name of that organization? Excel Alaska. So that might be a way to make a connection there and see if there aren't other folks from around Alaska that would be interested.
And you can find me on Facebook through Tundra Vision.
Okay, great. Yes.
Excellent.
Excel Alaska, they have a great Facebook page. And they
okay.
have of great sessions during the summertime where all these kids from the YK Delta and around the state come into Anchorage
for training. That is so cool.
That great.
Is so cool.
Well, I'll come find you on Excel Alaska.
Jeff, thank you. It's great to hear from you and to have somebody be able to talk about a game that's older than American baseball here. So that's great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We love Alaska Public Media and all the shows, your show and all the shows.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Thank you so much. So we actually need to take a little break. I'm Kathleen McCoy. My guest is Katie Ringsmith. We're talking about American baseball and Alaska baseball. And we'll be back after just a short break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and today we're talking American baseball in Alaska, but also Alaska baseball. We just had a fabulous caller describe growing up in rural areas and playing a game that he told us how it's like baseball, but how it's not like quite like baseball. I'm hoping that some connection gets made here among people in Anchorage who want to play what they called Eskimo baseball. That was really fun. But Katie, welcome back. You are a fan of baseball, a historian of baseball, and you love sharing it with the public. And so you curated the Anchorage Museum's wonderful home field advantage. So we want to go on in the second half hour and talk about some things like, well, some of the cult. We're going to talk about the culture of baseball, but how it emerged in Anchorage. I mean, we talked a little bit about women playing a lot, but there were also some sort of racial barriers that were broken. Let's just talk about some of that.
Oh, sure. You know, baseball is surrounded with mythology. And one of the myths of baseball is a democratic game, the great equalizer, a game mm-hmm. of democracy. But the sad reality is much of that was the big lie if you were African-American. Black baseball players, when the game first came out after the Civil War, played. But by the late 19th century, as racism became more entrenched into American society, African Americans were prevented from playing the game. And again, even before Jim Crow practices were codified by the Supreme Court, owners of American League Baseball, right, they had what they called the gentleman's agreement that said they didn't want black ball players, and black ball players would not play in the major leagues until Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947. Now, when you look at photographs of early Anchorage, you'll see at least one African-American player, if not several more. It's hard to tell. I haven't done enough research to determine who all these people are.
Yeah.
All I know, I just have one name, and his name was Aggie, and he played for the Alaska Railroad team. Now, when I was at a conference in Minnesota, I went to an exhibit on the Negro Leagues. And the curator of that exhibit was a fellow named Frank White, who just happened to be best friends with Dave Winfield. Mm. So he knew a little bit about Anchorage baseball, Alaska baseball. And so it was really fun talking with this guy. He also came up through the Minnesota Twins organization. He played mm-hmm. professional ball for them. And Frank White's father played for the Negro Leagues as well.
Okay.
And so I asked him, I said, what do you think about this guy? How do you think he ended up here? And he said, well, his thinking was that these, especially in 1915, these black ball players who wanted to keep playing ball, the Negro Leagues hadn't been established yet. So they may have gone up into Canada to play baseball. And he said it's quite likely that this fellow named Aggie got a job working on the Alaska Railroad, and the Alaska Railroad had a ball team. And so, Anchorage didn't discriminate. They let women play, and obviously they didn't discriminate against African Americans. Now, it's hard to really say that this was a movement, this was ground, you know, breaking, because there just weren't enough African Americans to say that. But what baseball does is it gives you a little window, a lens through which we can better understand the people who were up here. And it wasn't just the players. If you look, if you really start looking at the background, the spectators, you'll see that, yeah, they were people from all over the place, and they were diverse as well.
Right. I'm going to throw out our phone number for any listeners who've got questions about the history of baseball or indigenous baseball. So 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 around the state, or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm thinking of some of the photos I looked at. There were Filipino teams, right? Mm-hmm. And there were also Alaska Native teams that were in more traditional American baseball. So there were many, many different types of people playing, either intermingled in teams, or they had their own teams.
Yeah. Right?
Probably Southeast probably had, I think it was Ketchikan where I saw the Filipinos.
Yeah. Baseball, you know, again, within those diamonds, it just wasn't a game, right? It also was a platform for American social values.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those, the missionaries, definitely used baseball as a tool of Americanization and assimilation, without a doubt. And a lot of the young Native players baseball was being used to introduce American values and American ways to these young Native kids, without a doubt. You know, Sheldon Jackson's team played baseball.
Did Mount Edgecombe have a team? Who had team? Did boarding schools have teams?
Oh yeah, but it wasn't just about power and authority and forcing Alaska Native kids to play this very American game. But it was also the time, right? Missionaries at that time, like. The rest of them, the progressives of America, were really trying to toughen up America. Remember, Teddy Roosevelt is president. Mm-hmm. He had a big impact. This is the beginning of things like the Salvation Army. Let's put a little muscle in. Billy Sundays going around, talking about the importance of the church, and so it was also
the
about
spirit of,
yeah,
of,
and the physical fitness that was really important. So baseball was a way to accentuate that. Also, baseball was used to challenge the blue laws, which was you can't play baseball on Sundays.
You're not supposed to do anything on Sundays.
Yeah, but. So it was.
How did they get around that?
Well, they said if you're going to play baseball in Alaska, you got to travel. And you got to play baseball on Sunday, right? Or you're not going to play baseball. But it was also, again, they said, use baseball as a way to, push back the demons. And this was...
to be healthy and happy.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
To play baseball.
And so you do see those social values take place on the diamond.
We talked a little bit about gambling way back historically on games. But do you know, was there gambling on Anchorage games?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there was.
Yeah, they made tons of money. They would go down and they play against Seward. And so gambling was a good moneymaker. But what you're really seeing is the beginning of town identities. And that rivalry was profitable, but it also really distinguished these towns with their communities.
Yeah.
And the communities and people all start to develop a common theme, right?
Yeah.
So they'd have these great rivalries with Seward.
That's amazing. I remember seeing an image that Anchorage teams would go and play in Potter Creek, and there was a railroad spur line or something, and there was one image of just kind of a flatbed, just loaded with people. The women were dressed up. They really looked like they were going someplace, and they were just going to what we would call Potter Marsh today. Is that right?
Yeah, that was where the Turnagain Arm team played.
Yeah. One of the questions, where else did they play in Anchorage? There was Ship Creek. We talked about that.
Athletic Park.
The Athletic, then, where the museum is now.
Yeah. Matsu Junction and then Turnagain.
What about the park strip? Were there games on the park strip or not till much later?
Yeah, not till later. That was actually an aviation strip and slash golf course.
Yeah.
So there's another book, golf.
But I did want to mention, too,
the Filipino work.
Yes.
So not only do you have the missionary influence, you'll have the corporate influence, right? So Kennecott. the Alaska Packers Association. Those were the big corporations in Alaska in the early 20th century.
Right.
And baseball was important. There's this fantastic photograph out at Kennecott with the mill site. And there's this big game, of course, on the 4th of July, because that was really the day that everybody got off work. They played baseball, and they played actually right on the edge of the Kennecott Glacier, which is a pretty cool place to play baseball.
Yes.
But it was a way in which corporate owners with these very diverse crews could address maybe conflict.
Tension.
Right, tension, mm-hmm. while at the same time build camaraderie mm-hmm. among their working force. And it worked exceedingly well. And the salmon canneries were doing the same thing with their diverse workforce.
Mm-hmm.
I have wonderful footage that I got from the University of Washington mm-hmm. of canneries supporting. And you see, you know, not just Filipinos, but Alaska Natives, both the white male and female workers all playing together baseball.
See, we really do know how to do this. We can get along. We just have to have the right game and the right attitude, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think that it's a great way to bring people together.
Yeah. I was wondering whether alcohol was ever... I never saw in any of the pictures, you never saw people kind of drinking beer or anything. It seemed more like it was really all focused on the game and it wasn't about food really that much.
Yeah, I think in those early years, they really were trying to remove the stigma that a lot of the ballparks in the lower 48 might have carried before the great, you know, Babe Ruth years and mm-hmm. before the stadiums became cathedrals.
Mm-hmm.
And
and
so, you know, women were there. And so there were just rules of...
A little more decorum.
Exactly. Children went to these games,
yeah.
right? So,
yeah.
So I really don't know too much about alcohol. You're also in the middle of the bone dry laws.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, alcohol probably wasn't prevalent till
part of the
right.
Yeah. We wanted to talk a little bit about how the Alaska Baseball League got started up here, and I listened to a couple of the videos that you shared with me, and one was. I think it was Tom
Seaver
talking about that it was kind of a powerhouse up here.
It was.
College kids wanted to come, and there were scouts up here.
Yep.
And it really, I got the impression from listening to him talk that eventually the lower 48, it expanded.
Yeah.
These college, but in the beginning, Alaska was a really great place to come. And I mean, was it just Red Boucher and a vision that he had and the connections he had with coaches in the lower 48?
I'd say the teams probably feel that it still is a great place. I mean, mm-hmm. you have James Paxton, who's pitching for the Mariners. He played for the Pilots just not too long ago. So, yeah, it's still bringing up it. But you're right. It did change. But for a while there, especially in the 70s and 80s, Alaska was the place to go to play baseball.
That's amazing.
You know, you had 68, the Glacier Pilots, 74, the Peninsula Oilers. Then in 76, I love these names, by the way, you had the Valley Green Giants. Best name. Then you had the North Pole Knicks. Santa Claus was uh-huh. the awesome. And they ended up, because it was so expensive to travel, the more they won, it actually forced them to, they couldn't afford. Yeah, right. So so then they were eventually replaced with the Mattoo Miners, which is around today. And it was the Cook Inlet Bucks and then became the Anchorage Bucks.
Right.
And again, they're still producing some great ball players. And then just recently, the Chinooks out in Chugiak, where
right.
we take my little men to watch.
Right.
And just to give you an idea of the type of players that this league produced, Harold Reynolds, Jacoby Ellsbury, Jason Giambi, Tony Francona played
Amazing.
Here, Mark McGuire, Jared Weaver, who's also still pitching, and Barry Bonds. He actually didn't play up here, but he played with the Gold Panthers. He was, they recognized his
That's
talents
amazing.
Early on.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, another theme that I see in all the photographs that I saw at the exhibit and that you shared with me is the place of kids here. You know, they're standing with their glove right outside the fence watching the game, or sometimes they're pitching teaching their own little, there's a great shot of a little, looks like a three-year-old on a downtown Anchorage dirt street with a big windup, and he's just going to deliver a pitch, and he's about, comes up to about your knee, you know? So kids, and there probably weren't that many kids in early Anchorage, you know? They were probably pretty precious commodity.
Oh, absolutely. In early Alaska, children were,
rare.
Rare, and so absolutely. And it is just wonderful seeing these adorable children in these cute little uniforms, right? We can thank William Mulcahy for really establishing baseball in Alaska for kids. He came up to work for the Alaska Railroad. He kind of took over the league, actually, after Anchorage Incorporated, the railroad pulls out. And it was him. He really
had this passion
for this game.
And that's how we have Mulcahy Stadium.
Yeah, and he started the Little League program in 1950. And you're right, the stadium's named after him. And again, these children, they're super cute, but they also made history, too. In 1968, the Anchorage Babe Ruth program, which was a form of the Little League, they actually went and played in the, I think it was the Northwest Tournament, and they were the first to actually represent Alaska at the national
stage. The kids of Alaska, they actually made history.
They lost, so they didn't win. It was the Pilots who would win the next year, but baseball was the one, you know, really gave Alaska that first real introduction to the world of sports in the lower 48.
You know, when I look at the pictures, the older pictures, the players seem older. They look older. And then they seem to get younger. And we're probably getting into the Little League era as the pictures start to have color.
Yeah, right.
And the players look younger.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what their first caller, she asked about is how is Little League doing today? And
good question, yeah.
As a mother of two Little Leaguers, I'd say is doing pretty well. You know, I met my husband playing baseball on the Park Strip
in the
Lawyer League. I did. So all of those games are really active. So people are out there enjoying the long Arctic nights and playing baseball. And that's how I met my husband. And then now we have two little boys who play in the Kinnick League.
That's
and
great.
It is. It's just there's all the, you know, we're freezing to death in May,
right.
You know, watching these really long baseball games.
But
it's wonderful. And
it
does give people a sense of camaraderie.
Yeah. I also saw, and I think people were, I assume they still do it, but the snowshoe softball.
Oh, yeah.
In the Fur Rondi.
Yeah.
I had worked with people that were completely into that and just had so much fun playing in snowshoes. I wanted to talk about the field in Nome because we discussed earlier that it was such a unique field. And let me throw out the numbers one more time in case people have a last question for you, Katie. 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 and hometown@alaskapublic.org for your email. That field, I mean, you talked a lot about it takes room to play baseball. That's in that little video. You know, it's not easy. You just can't pull up a chair and play a game.
Right.
But what were some of the efforts they had to go to in Nome to get a really good field?
A good field in the tundra?
Yeah.
You'd think that they'd have a lot of other things to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's pretty extraordinary. About as far away on the North American continent as you can get, they're playing baseball.
Mm-hmm.
What they did is they stripped the permafrost off the tundra. They put thousands of burlap bags down that they got from the AC store, the local AC store. And then they got sand from the beach, the golden beaches of Nome, and dumped them right onto
that
field.
After they looked for gold first.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then Terrence Cole called this field one of the most unique baseball fields in America. So that was a very interesting expression of how, you know, this American game is distinctly shaped by Alaska.
Yeah.
Another, I think, interesting field situation is Ketchikan. You know, Ketchikan didn't have a lot of space for baseball.
You go right up the side of the hill,
exactly.
Right?
So they played on the mud flats, the tidal flats. And again, that challenges that whole mythology of baseball, its rhythms, its timeliness, because no one told the Pacific Ocean, you know, when the tide comes up, it didn't matter what the score was. It didn't matter what inning it was in.
Yeah.
That was the end of the game.
Yeah. Twice a day, everything got wiped out by the tide. And it looks really flat. The pictures where you see of Ketchikan, the town comes down, then everybody's down on the flats.
Right.
And it is flat.
Yeah.
Really flat.
And again, it kind of recreated the game. You know, the field itself was transformed every time the tide came up and washed it away.
Yeah. I think I also saw a picture of St. Lawrence Island, a game on St. Lawrence Island.
Oh, yeah. They played on Alaska. The military played a lot of baseball.
Right.
You know, it really did make those 18-year-old kids feel like they weren't that far away from home. So it helped with morale. In fact, baseball was the first thing they sent out in the equipment, in the supplies, baseball stuff.
The stuff to play with games. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's part of the work you've presented, Sidney Lawrence, he took a famous photograph in 1915, but he also did a book.
That's Mockatons.
Oh, this is Mockatons. I'm sorry. Which he basically did these drawings or sketches or pointillism of, and I haven't read the stories, but the pictures are fantastic, black and white. Really, I mean, they're classic. Mm-hmm. Really, really, really classic. So, and do you know much about his enthusiasm for the game, or was it mostly that?
I think it was a starving artist, but I know that he also, loved the game too. But again, what I love about it is it merges that mythology, that last frontier, of course, which Mockatons was so famous for, but also with the mythology of baseball, the America's pastime. And there's these, there's two enormous meta mythology kind of colliding
Alaska
together.
And Yeah.
And what I always find really kind of neat about this mythology is that whether, baseball was brought, it was played, it was passed on by dissimilar people who were filled with these hopes and these dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball created fields of dreams, but Alaska created fields of dreamers. That's kind of who we are. We do think big. We think beyond. That's what I always love about Alaskans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in many ways, that's why they embrace this game early on.
Yeah. It taps into something. I mean, they go to the roots, but they don't hesitate to change it if they need to. I mean, they respect some pieces of it, but if they have to do something else to make it work, like, integrate their teams or have women's leagues or men and women playing against each other, which wasn't really being done in other areas, they go for it.
Yeah, they brought these diamonds to bring with them a little piece of home. And yet when they got here, whether it was overcoming social barriers or dealing with the environment of which, they had the seasons playing under the midnight sun, they made baseball, this American game, something distinctly Alaskan. Mm-hmm. In the words of Walt Whitman himself, we made it our game.
Mm-hmm. And you said you've been to the Midnight Sun game.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. We took the boys up this summer and just had a great time. So I would...
When does it happen? Is it just one?
It's on solstice. Okay. And it is very light there. It's amazing. It's a great experience. I think all Alaskans should go to Fairbanks for the Midnight Sun game. And I'd also say go to your ballpark on the 4th of July.
That's something
we did
family
that
does.
Too.
We ride our bike on the Chesterkeek Trail, go to there, and just sit back and relax. And it's so small town and fun, and the game is real close, and it's just really fun.
And you know, it hasn't changed that much in 100 years. 100 years at that Ship Creek, and you see all those fans sitting on stumps, right? That diverse crowd, people from all over the place.
Yes.
And you go to Mulcahy, you watch the Pilots and the Bucks play and battle it out on the 4th of July, and that diversity is still expressed in our stands, our 100-language city, and that's a wonderful thing.
And we still have college players coming up from all over the U.S.
And we still have them all coming up.
And we want to remind people about the Ken Burns, Jackie Robinson documentary. It's 4 hours broken up into two-hour parts. Part one is Monday, April 11th at 8, and part two is Tuesday, April 12th at 8. And there you go. I'm glad we got that in. All right. Katie, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure. And I guess we'll see you out on the ball field somewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right? Everybody, play ball.
Play ball. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth is back as your host, and he's going to be talking about veterans and their health. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thank you.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.